And so their whole approach.
I just want to thank you, Bishop, for coming here and for being open and for sharing with us. Because one of my biggest problems in dealing with our son's homosexuality has been our relationship with him and to the church. Being devout Catholics for all our lives and being reared in Catholic tradition and hearing priests that we have gone to for some kind of support and comfort in dealing with this, which we've received none, it's been hard to put it together. Like, do we belong in the church? Are we wrong in affirming him? It's been really very confusing the last 5 or 6 years. But knowing, seeing how our church has been progressing little by little in the last few years, and then hearing you publicly stand there and affirm us and encourage us is a great comfort to me and to other parents, I'm sure. And I know that this is just at the beginning, and I may not see it in my lifetime, but I love my church, and I don't want to leave my church. And I'm praying that my son will someday find the door open to him to come back into the church. But he dearly loves his church also. And he has tried other churches in his search, and he said, I'm Catholic, and I want to be Catholic.
Yeah.
And so I hope that...
Right. Okay, well... You're absolutely right. You should stay in the church and struggle within the church to help bring about change. It saddens me to say it, but I know that you still will find some experiences that are going to be very hurtful. Some priests or bishops within the church, or in civil society too. I mean, we still will have to fight in certain places for laws that prevent discrimination and in fact, isn't it the Colorado law that's going to the Supreme Court?
On Tuesday, anyway, 1 hour, Supreme Court justices will hear it.
Yeah, and that could be a very crucial, yeah, you spoke about that last night, that's right, yeah.
But the ironic thing is that a law of such importance, it's only going to be have a total time of 1 hour.
Yeah. So we're still going to find the struggle, and I think all of us will face it. There'll be attacks against us and so on. And yet, I suppose for ourselves, especially, we I hope can be willing to accept whatever suffering goes with that for the sake of our sons and daughters or brothers or sisters, who suffer even more, I think, and have suffered more because of the church and because of attitudes in civil society. But if we can stay together and accept that suffering, it's one of those areas where it can be a very clear expression of what we call the act of love or the nonviolence of Jesus, where I have a willingness to accept suffering rather than to inflict suffering. Yeah, I have a willingness to absorb hatred rather than inflict hatred. And if I can do that in that spirit of Jesus in this totally nonviolent way, we can transform society. That's what active love does. The nonviolence of Jesus transforms. It doesn't just overturn and destroy, it transforms. And so that's what our call, I think, is very much to the act of love or the nonviolence of Jesus. So I hope all of us can keep on praying that we ourselves are strong enough to act this way. And continue to hope that the church is going to change, and it will. I have no question about it, no doubt about it whatsoever.
Where can I get a copy of that article that you read of the Angry Young Man
and
where you found God in
the first time? That was in America Magazine, which is a magazine published by the Jesuits in New York City, and it was May 8th, 1993. So you could.
Bob has asked us tomorrow to share with some of what we're doing and what we've learned. We feel education is such a big piece of that. We have prepared a packet with materials. That article is.
Oh, great, okay. Yeah. Have you got the other article?
Both Andrew Sullivan articles.
And the one that followed right after
it?
What do we say to our children?
Right.
Yeah, that's a very marvelous article, too.
And the, also the two NPR articles about you are in there as well.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I happen to have the article by Cardinal Hill. I have that whole article.
Oh, right. That appeared in Origins, and that's very good, too.
In very recent America, there's an article about a pastoral attitude toward homosexuals, which is paired with another article, which I was ready to throw the magazine across the room when I was reading it. And when I turned to read the second article, my faith in America was restored.
Yeah, that's just this week.
It's a very recent one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But also, I would like to say that I saw that the bishop in general, the Catholic bishop's attitude toward homosexuality was sort of like the military's, don't ask, don't tell. Mm-hmm. And I saw a quote from John Tracy Ellis, and he said, God doesn't need our lies. And I think that's a powerful thing for me to remember, that subterfuge and avoiding the issue, God doesn't need those lies, and I don't think the church does either. So I think that, just to make people live a lie is really very wrong.
So you're not suggesting that we ought to have the policy of don't ask, don't.
No, I think that's very wrong. I think we need truth and we need openness.
Exactly.
People should be free to say who they are.
Right.
And to be welcomed.
Yeah. See, and that, yeah, that's so important, because if we just had this other attitude of, just keep it sort of under the surface, then we'll never learn from the experience.
Exactly.
And that's what's gone on for centuries already. And so we need to bring this forward. Even though it's going to be painful, we need to bring it forward. And that's why, among the bishops, I'm ready to help bring it forward, because I don't want us just to push it aside and pretend it's not there. That's part of the way the bishops function in regard to so many major issues within the church. We try to go along as though they're not there, like a vocation problem. You will not hear the bishops explore the real depths of that problem. They just say, well, we got to pray more for vocations. And it's a lot deeper than that. But they won't talk about it. And so on this issue, that's been the way it's been. But we got to push it out there in the open.
Bishop, I think one of the problems I see in the church is that the issue is alive and well in the Catholic Church. I know for a fact that there are retreats given for priests that have AIDS and priests that are gay. And I feel that the church wants to kind of keep us in the closet, because the priests that are out there today dealing with their own sexuality will begin to feel they have support, and that it will become more out in the church. And the church is trying very hard today, between the pedophile problem and the priests that have either a drug problem or the priests that have. There are problems within this large organization, and we've always had this aura of the priesthood that they were the perfect human beings to try to strive to be. And in actuality, they are real human beings. And they are struggling with this concept or this natural feeling that someone either wants to love another human being, or a dog or a cat or something like that. Everybody wants to love something. And I think the more we have, I think the secret to this whole issue are the parents of the children who are gay and lesbian. I've always said that people who are gay and lesbian were created in the same way that a heterosexual was. There was nothing extraordinary done to create this human being.
Right. Yeah, and
it's so getting to be, I think the more we come out, or the more we try to let people know that we have a gay or lesbian child, the numbers will begin to grow, and then the church won't be able to not deal with this issue.
Right.
There was a bishop who died in New York City recently. Mm-hmm. There was Bishop Moore.
Mm-hmm.
Happened to know. He did not die of an undisclosed illness. I happened to know why he died.
Mm-hmm. Right. And And that seemed pretty clear. And I found it very sad that they weren't ready to say that. Because that could be an example for the whole church. Now, we just did the same thing in Detroit. We had a priest who definitely died of AIDS. And yet the whole thing was just kind of glossed over, pretended that it wasn't the case. And we lost a lot because of it.
And he lost a lot.
Yeah, that's what I mean. The whole church lost it.
He's a human being.
Oh, right.
He lost an awful lot.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, he was not allowed to even die saying who he really is. Yeah. And that's a terrible, marginalization of the person who he really is. And we must not do that. But this whole thing, but why another reason it's going to be very difficult for the church, institutionally and for the bishops, is because, as I sort of hinted at or said very briefly last night, we have not within our seminary prepared people for a healthy sexuality, a healthy way of dealing with their own sexuality. So we have a lot of priests that are very underdeveloped when it comes to an understanding of their sexuality and who they are. As I mentioned again last night, we were trained to just avoid the whole issue, trained to be non-relational. That was these warnings about particular friendship. See, it meant, obviously you would never have a friendship with a young woman if you're in the seminary. We are totally forbidden to date, to even have ordinary adolescent interaction with girls. And when you're in the seminary for 12 years, starting at 13 or 14 years of age, you go through a whole period of development where there's no social interaction. But then we were also warned, don't have any real friendships with other young men in the seminary. So you were taught how to build a wall around yourself so that you would be totally unrelational. Now, on a superficial level, and this was encouraged, on a superficial level, you could have a lot of camaraderie and that sort of thing. But it always had to be very superficial. There was never any understanding of how intimacy is an important part of any human person's life. And it's somewhat discouraging in a way that we, when we talk about the lack of vocations and what's happening in the seminaries and so on, we're going backwards, actually, right at the moment. It's so discouraging, that part. Ken Untener, the Bishop of Saginaw, who was one of the other speakers 4 years ago, had been the rector of St. John's Seminary in Detroit before he was made a bishop. And in that seminary, when he was rector, this is a major seminary, it was for the whole province of Michigan, he put in some programs on sexuality, and it was an attempt to sensitize all of these people getting ready for ordination, sensitize them to the whole issue of sex and sexuality, and get them to come to know who they are. If they're homosexual, they should know that before they're ordained, not repress it. And just before he was to be ordained a bishop, some people had collected materials from some of the stuff he did, and they sent him to Rome. And his ordination as a bishop was stopped. And it was going to be totally stopped. And it was only because, he had to go over there and fight for it. Cardinal Dearden had to go over there and fight for it. And finally, at the last minute, the Pope said, okay, you can be ordained. But it was all because he had tried to make this very progressive development within the church. And then after Cardinal Dearden retired, we got a bishop who was sent, I'm sure, with the mandate, clean up that seminary. And so everything was pushed back, and all of those kinds of things were eliminated. And so it's going to be a tough struggle because we keep going back and forth like this. Ken got ordained, and he is functioning very effectively as a bishop, and he's doing different things in his diocese. And so it's still, he is he's one who's promoter of, he's a catalyst for change in the church, and then there's other like him, and so it's going to keep on happening. But I just mentioned that to show you it will be a constant struggle, and we're not ready within the institutional church to look at these hard issues and confront them the way we should, and That saddens me, but it also makes me more determined. I have a little stubborn streak in me. And so when I find out, you know, that you got to work harder, well, I'll work harder, that's all. And so you do. And that's what I hope when we were praying for courage, you know, we ought to pray for some stubbornness, I think. Not going to give up. Okay.
Bishop, how does the church deal with your activity on this issue?
My activity?
Have you had any such discussions as far as you're involved in?
Well, only before I did the talk. I have never heard a thing since, which is fine. I do try to make sure that what I say is within a framework of Catholic teaching, but I suppose I keep on trying to push it, you know, to the edge all the way, and especially in this area to insist that it's not a completed Catholic teaching, which it isn't. I mean, and there's very little in moral theology that you can say you have definitive teaching on once you get past sort of the general norms, do good and avoid evil. You know, that's the basic principle of all human life, and we're sure of that. You know, that we're called to do good and avoid evil. But then when you start bringing that down into particular cases, what's good, what's evil, how do you do it, and so on, the further you get from the basic principle, the more uncertainty there is, and the more we have to keep discovering what is right and what is wrong. And you'll find, and I'll share with you in a minute here, how the church has changed. And so I keep pushing to bring about the change that I think is necessary. But so far, I've never, since that original kind of warning that I got, I've never heard anything since. So I'm happy. I don't mind, in this case, in a sense, being ignored. Sooner or later, I suppose, there will be something. Well, I'm hoping that we can get enough interest going that there's going to be some clash over this, because that's what it's going to be within the bishops' conference, that we can force it into the open and the bishops have to talk about it. And there will be those who will want to have a very strong, definitive statement of condemnation. I mean, people that, isn't the organization called Courage?
Yes.
You know, people who firmly believe in that, and that if you work at this, you can change these people. You know, there's something wrong with them, make them right. And that's going to be the struggle. And yet I don't think we have to be afraid of the struggle. The truth will make us free, finally. And I think as long as we keep searching for the truth and don't think we have it, and that's where I really differ with those people. They're so sure of themselves. They got the truth. But that isn't so. You know, we don't have the truth. We keep searching for it. And that's so true in history of church. If you want, let me just share this with you because I find it very helpful. It's in that article about what do we say to our children. And so you'll have a copy of it. But just so you won't just set that aside and not read it, here, this shows you how the church's understanding on sexuality has changed unbelievably in a way. The article at the end speaks about when Pope Gregory the Great, in a famous letter to Augustine of Canterbury, so this goes back to the beginning of the 7th century, back in 600, pointed out that since even, and here's a quote from Pope Gregory, even the lawful intercourse of the wedded cannot take place without pleasure of the flesh, entrance into a sacred place should be abstained from, because the pleasure itself can by no means be without sin. You know, yeah, right. You laugh because, you know, the Pope couldn't possibly get away with saying that today. You know, not after the developments that have happened within our understanding of the theology of marriage. And yet, this is a Pope writing very solemnly to the new primate, or for the first primate of England. Cardinal Hume's is his successor. And he was merely repeating the Augustinian, that is the other Augustine from Hippo, and the late medieval consensus, consensus that passion in general makes one less human. Augustine of Hippo had argued against those who derided marriage that, quote, in marriage, intercourse for the purpose of generation has no fault attached to it. Though, if a married couple have sex for pleasure, they are committing sin, a sin very difficult to avoid. And so you ought not But, you know, that was taught right up and almost until, I mean, not quite in that explicit a way, but when I was in the seminary, and probably when Bob was in the seminary, we were still learning a moral theology of marriage that was more of a canon law of marriage. And marriage was a contract. There was, you in the contract, you signed over the right to your body, and it was for the three ends of marriage, which were procreation and education of children. The mutual love was accepted as secondary purpose, and to avoid concupiscence. That's why you got married, those three reasons. See? And it was not a very healthy understanding of marriage and not a very adequate understanding of marriage, and certainly not an understanding of marriage that came from the experience of married people. See, there again, I mentioned that last night, Patty Crowley's book, The Turning Point, the experience of married people has influenced the teaching of the church. And so you don't have something so absurd as what Pope Gregory the Great wrote to St. Augustine, of the Archbishop of Canterbury. And then in the article, he just points out, so consistent and so coherent was this once traditional view of sex that it is hard for some to understand just how thoroughly the church has rejected it in its official teachings. Any pope today would shrink from arguing, as Pope Gregory the Great did in his work of advice for pastoral counselors, that marriage is for the second best, for the weak who cannot help themselves. So we have changed, thank God. But and I offer that though as proof that we can still change more. And now that we're beginning to confront the whole issue of homosexuality, we'll change on that too, once we begin to surface the experience of people. Like Andrew Sullivan, who says, I found God when I found love in another human being, that other human being being my male partner. That's where I found God. And just to give you a few other samples of where church has changed, where the church once argued passionately against such things as freedom of the press and of religion, as Pope Pius IX, Syllabus of Errors, a century ago, we argued, the Pope condemned that. Freedom of the press was condemned by the Catholic Church. Freedom of religion was condemned by the Catholic Church. You were anathema if you believed in such things. And now, the Church presupposes them in papal documents. And this is one of the kind of cute things that we do. See, the Pope never said, oh, that other Pope was wrong. It suddenly, we just suddenly start doing the opposite. And before you know it, the Catholic Church is all for freedom of the press, freedom of religion, freedom of speech. The Pope at the UN the other day was, you know, saying the Catholic Church is right out in the forefront of all these things, and for human rights. And so it just kind of slides from one to another, but it does move, so that's the thing. Surely the spirit of that old anti-democrat, Gregory the 16th, must have been astonished at a successor who invoked democratic values in his fight against communism, and he's talking about John Paul II. And when John Paul II, in Familiaris Consortio, which is a document he wrote about marriage, praises the sexual act in marriage as a way of communicating love, its unitive function, and not just making babies, procreative function, or providing a remedy for concupiscence. He is implicitly rejecting a restricted view of the sexual act that made sense to the Christian tradition for more than a millennium. And so for over 1,000 years, we taught the opposite. Now suddenly John Paul II, you read that document on marriage, he says just the opposite of what Pope Gregory said. So anyway, this evolution in teaching and understanding will happen. Bob, your packet, I don't know if you do, it's called A Christian Homosexuality with a question mark. It's an article from Commonweal that might be worth getting. It's December 5th, 1980. And it's a discussion in the light of scripture, authority, and reason. And the scriptural part especially would be helpful. Because that, I'm sure you've all experienced that, where somebody tell you, well, look what St. Paul said. Look what it says in the book of Leviticus. Look, and although one article I read just reads that, you look in the Gospel, Jesus never said one thing. Jesus, never, one thing. But some others did. But this would help you in the scriptural. And there's other places you can go too, but this is written for ordinary folks like ourselves who aren't scripture scholars, and I think it's very helpful. Okay, more questions. Yes?
My daughter has a bumper sticker that says, "Why be normal?"
That's right. We're all just slightly abnormal, I'm sure. But again, you see, that's the diversity of creation. You know, God didn't make us all the same. Thank goodness he didn't, or she didn't. Right. Yes?
We move very slowly as a church, but I can recall not too long ago when parents were asked to refuse to attend a wedding of their children if their children married outside the church. And they were told they could not even accept them in their own home. And that's really not all that long ago.
Oh, no. That was happening when I was ordained.
So when we look to see where the church has come, I mean, you wouldn't even bat an eyelash today. It wouldn't happen in anybody's family today. As a matter of fact, there's a welcoming.
Absolutely right.
So I think hope, but not without the major struggle.
Exactly, yeah. And look how quickly that change happened, too. I mean, it really did happen quickly.
But it came from the people.
Right. And see, again, you know, a parent was being told, deny your son or your daughter, have nothing to do with them. Well, that goes against nature. And it's wrong. It just, and yet, we did put up with it for some reason. But then suddenly people just said, it is wrong, and I won't do it. And pretty soon the whole church changed very quickly. And again, it just makes me realize how important all of you are. Now, as parents, if more parents would, you know, if we can keep reaching out and get other parents to do this, it's so powerful. I just reminded of, because of that, of the experience I had in Minnesota when I went there at a parish called Pax Christi. Part of the program one night was a panel, and they had two, a gay man, a lesbian woman, speak of their experience. And when you hear people speak, you know, it really is moving. But then they had two parents speak, and they had come out before this whole parish. And, you know, and at first they were, you know, when their daughter first came out, they accepted her, but they were kind of not too sure. They wanted the whole parish to know it, because they were very active, prominent people in the parish. Well, they did. And the whole parish has now really come around. It was marvelous. That night there must have been 300 or 400 people at this session from this parish, mostly from some other parishes too. But what that couple did in that parish, it's extraordinary. And it's changing the attitudes of people. And if we could have something like that happen in every parish in the United States, quickly this whole thing would change. No? Okay.
I just wanted to thank you for being here instead of the aqueduct or
right. Yeah. Well, I must confess I haven't gone to see the Pope since 1979, I think it was. Yeah, I just can't do that. But somebody asked me before, and I may as well just say this, it was a question, so
it's not my
initiative. about same-sex marriages. And how I would respond to that. And at the moment, I guess I would say that I would not witness one. If it was really, in the sense that I could not confer the sacrament, I don't think. For the same reason, in the sense that I can't confer the sacrament of ordination on a woman, because it becomes invalid. And so it's not really a sacrament. And that's because of restrictions that the church puts on what can make a valid sacrament. And I, in my own sacramental theology, I don't think I can just change what makes a sacrament valid or not valid. For example, I can't decide to use something other than water for baptism and say it's a valid sacrament. Now, God doesn't act only through sacraments, however. And that's, I think, very important for us to know. Now, a person can be reborn into the life of Jesus without my pouring water over that person or without anybody pouring water. The church doesn't only forgive sins because you go and confess your sins to a priest. The forgiveness of sins happens in unlimited ways. The sacrament is an important ritualization of that forgiveness of sins, or the sacrament, an important ritualization of a person being reborn into Jesus. A sacrament is an important ritualization of the communion of life to people. And so I'm not saying they're not important, but they're not. God isn't limited to the sacrament in acting. And so God can bless this union of two people without conferring a sacrament. Now, it may get to the point where we change what makes a valid sacrament so that it could be a sacrament. Now, I could see being present to bless a couple and to pray for them, but I would not say that I was celebrating the sacrament of marriage, simply because it doesn't come within what the church sets forth as the requirements for a valid sacrament. And again, sometimes when I'm with women groups especially, they say, why don't you just ordain a woman? Well, I would, except that if I did, it wouldn't just be like it is in the Episcopal Church, where when the bishops did it, it was illicit. See, and that's what it was. The church accepted the validity of that ordination so those women could function as priests, and the whole church would have to accept that what they did was valid as priests because they had been ordained. It was illicit. It went against the law. It was a kind of an ecclesiastical disobedience within the church. But in the Catholic Church, it's different because of our whole understanding of sacramentality and what makes a valid sacrament. And so if I were to ordain a woman, I would, in a sense, I'd have to start my own church, because she wouldn't be ordained within the framework of the Roman Catholic Church. And I don't want to start my own church. I got enough to do. And I don't feel I'm called anyway. But I hope that's helpful, how I see that. And I certainly support the idea that two people who are in a very profound love relationship and living that out need the blessings of the church and need prayer, just as any of us do when we embark on a vocation or a way of life, which is what they're doing. We need prayer, we need blessing, and we need to give it to one another. But it would not be... I wouldn't call it marriage, the sacrament of it.
Thank you. Okay?